Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's and the poker coach, Joe McGowan. I wanna hold them like they do in Texas, please. Brought to you by Poker Stars, Reactor Watches, and the Poker Players Alliance. Shut up and put your
money where your mouth is. Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got to know.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Welcome to the show. Today, we're going to catch up with Joe Catta, the reigning champion of the World Series of Poker main event, the kid who became a multi-millionaire when he beat the rest of the November 9 in a classic match last November at the Rio out in Las Vegas. We were with him at the NAPT a couple of weeks ago at the Venetian and got a chance to talk to him and see what he's been up to since then, and you'll hear that in just a little while. Also later on, another poker coach one-on-one segment with Joe McGowan talking with Andy Block, who went down to defeat to Annie Duke in the first round of the NBC Heads Up at Caesars Palace a couple of weekends ago. Of course, Annie Duke went on to roll through the rest of the field then, including my colleague Dennis Phillips, before finally beating Eric Seidel in the finale. You'll hear Andy Block talking about one of the big hands he played against Annie and get into some strategy there. And speaking of strategy, here's a conversation that Dennis and Joe and I recorded in our suite at the Venetian late one night when we were all out there for the NAPT.
One of the things I don't think we've talked about is whenever you have a big event like the NAPT or the circuit event that's coming to Harrah's St. Louis at the beginning of April, is the opportunity for people to get into some of these events, including the main event, by playing sit-and-go satellites. 9-10 people sitting down and paying, could be $65, could be all the way up to $520, where 10 people are trying to win enough to get into the main event. And there are sit-and-go buy-ins in between pretty much at every level. And when you play in these, there are certain strategies that you would use, because it's not like you're trying to run deep for an entire day. How long do most of these usually take, Dennis?
Actually, not that long. It depends upon the blind levels and the level you're doing, because they have these set up for a $300 event you can satellite into it, a $500 event you can satellite into it. Like you said, all the way down to $65 to get into these things on that.
Yeah, I mean, if you play for the World Series, the $10,000 buy-in tournament, $1,000 apiece, that one's going to go 4 hours.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you're doing something, you're trying to satellite in for a $300 tournament, you know, it might be 10 people at $33, and that one might be over in an hour.
Okay. Yep, absolutely.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about the strategies that people should use when they're sitting down and playing these single-table satellites at a major event where they want to win themselves lammers, the little plastic chips that will help them get into the bigger events.
Well, first of all, look at the end result you're trying to achieve. A lot of these will have maybe the top two get a placement where you don't have to win it. You just have to get down to two of them, eliminate the other eight people on that.
Mm-hmm. In fact, the other night at the Venetian, you were doing exactly that. You
that
sat down with a couple of friends, and it got down to three-handed. You knocked one guy out. Boom, tournament over.
Yep.
You and the other guy automatically both win, and you split whatever whatever the money is.
That was one of those rare times when I had 80% of the chips, and I'm going, no, let's keep playing.
And when you mention the lammers, if you have a seat, many times you have to take a seat. But sometimes, if you already have a seat, well, then you can take those lammers. That's like cash. You just go over to the line. Poker players, they all want to help out each other, and it's a great group. They'll buy them for you cash for cash. I mean, where you got 10 grand in lammers, they'll be in line. You're going to get your 10 grand fast.
Right.
Yeah. Right. But getting back to the actual table itself, and it does make a difference whether you're paying a $65 one or a $541 or whatever, because the quality of play does go up as you go up higher in it normally.
Right.
Normally. I've seen the exception.
I have too. Particularly as you get closer to the big events, people
who get
desperate are trying to do it, and they're doing it time and time and time and time and time.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't tell you how many times I've seen somebody buying into a $5,000 event by playing 10 to 12 satellites that cost them over $500
right.
apiece.
Right.
If they had just played no satellites, they could have bought in.
Yeah, there you go.
And I'll tell you, probably one of my top tips, I don't know if it's my number one tip, but one of the best things possible for making money for me is the closer you get to the event itself, that's when those satellites are just phenomenal. I mean, that's when people are dying to get in.
Yep.
They maybe really can't afford it. They want to take a shot. That's when you get the poorest play, the worst players. desperate to get in, and there's a lot of dead money in there. So those are really, really good spots to look for, is right before the event's going to start, that night before or the closest to it. Those are the easiest, juiciest, softest lineups you can typically find.
And a lot of the strategy that you use on a sit-and-go is similar to what you do in a tournament. Granted, there are some changes. The first thing I try to do on these is to sit back there and watch the rest of the play and analyze the players and figure out which ones are the weak ones, which ones are the desperate ones, which ones are not used to playing at a sit-and-go or anything like that.
Now, in many of these, you don't have much time to figure that out if the whole thing is going to last an hour and a half or two
hours. I disagree with that, because I'm telling you, most of these blinds are a good 15 minutes, and it only takes one time around the table to analyze most of your people. Granted, you might make a mistake every now and then, but for the most part, I guarantee one rotation around there, and I've got most of the people picked I think they are.
I was defining one time around the table as not that long.
Okay.
You know, in 10 or 15 minutes, I mean, what I'm saying is you're not going to need an hour to decipher the table and figure out who's playing how, et cetera, because people aren't going to be sitting back. Most times when you're playing a sit-and-go, there are always going to be a few people who are very active from the very start because they feel like you've got to get a lot of chips early on.
Yeah.
Now, how true is that?
Well, I think that's a mistake. That's one of the things that I like and look for. There's typically two or three guys that are going to take themselves out of the sit-and-go.
Yep.
Now, you got 10 people. They're all playing for first place to win the seat, which is most of them. You know, two or three of those guys are just going to knock themselves right out.
Yeah, what you end up with is, say, four people that are playing that way, and three of them knock each other out, and one of them ends up with a pile of chips in front of him. But you also know from the way he's played, he's very hard for him to shift gears and pull back, so that money's in action also.
Mm-hmm.
So the one guy that does catch the cards, the one guy that does catch the flush on the river, whatever the heck it happens to be, he's still in there, and he's got a decent amount. But exactly what you said, it happens. Those other three people are gone, and all of a sudden, you're down to only having to go against seven people.
It's a tough thing because I know with me, I like to get involved early because I want to catch the guys that give their money away.
Yeah.
But then sometimes I end up siphoning off some chips because I'm calling with the 6-8s, you know, suited and stuff like that because it's the blinds are cheap early on, and all of a sudden I've siphoned off 25% of my chips. So, but I want to catch those guys that are going to give it away early on. So it's great when I do catch them and I, you know, flop two pair or hit a hand and they give me their chips with a pair of tens or something, whatever it is, you know, early on. But then sometimes it can, you know, work against you.
Joe's got an excellent point here because it's a fine line you have to walk. You're trying to, you know, flop that straight with your 6-8 of hearts or something like that on it. And when you do, these guys are golden because they're going to pay you off on that. But if you bleed chips early in this, you start out with so few of them a lot of times that, and the levels do go up every 15 minutes, you can get yourself within the third level, the fourth level, all of a sudden you look down and went, I have to shove now. I've got nothing left.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Joe and I played a single table last summer at the World Series of Poker. We played a few of them together. But one of them was a really cheap buy-in. I don't remember what it was. But you only got 1,500 in chips, and the rounds were 15 minutes. So it started at 25-50, and 15 minutes into it, the blinds are going up to 50-100. Well, if you took a hit on one of those hands in that first 15 minutes, and now you're down to 900 in chips, but it, you know, by the time you get to the second round, you've got less than 10 times the big blind.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's also where, at the end, you know, for me, if I can just, in my mind, if I can just get to three-handed, if I can survive to three-handed, because once it gets to three-handed, you know, it's not a five-day tournament. This thing, you have to be willing, and it's unfortunate, you have to be willing to get in there with a king-10 versus an ace-jack.
Yep.
You know, some type of 60-40 type of deal and hope that you're the lucky one because there's typically not a lot of room to sit back and play quality hands and just wait it out and kind of outplay people. There is definitely a little more luck that's involved in these single table sit and goes because when it gets down to three handed, you've been around for a while and these blinds really shoot up there and pretty soon all three of you many times are forced to be all in.
Right. Yep.
Like, I get two cards. I have to go all in on the next hand with my chips. It gets that big
yes,
and that fast.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Talk about the discipline of playing a short stack in one of these events where, you know, again, you're not going to be playing all that long. You take a hit early on. You find yourself with less than 10 times the big blind, and you're still eight-handed.
Yeah, but what it does, it limits your play, which is exactly what you were alluding to. And I will give you a word of caution. You cannot be timid. If you've only got the 900 left and you catch one of these marginal hands, I have an ace 10 now and I'm in early position. I got, you know, all six people left still behind me to act on it. You can't limp in. You can't three exit. You got to go for it.
Yeah.
If I only got nine big blinds, I'm sorry. If I come in with a 2.5 times, it all of a sudden I have nothing left hardly. So
yeah, I mean,
it's totally different, Paul, than when you're playing in the main event, say, where there's 2 hour levels, and you're short. You can stick around and survive for an hour and wait
absolutely.
For maybe an ace king, or wait for a pocket nines or something that's somewhat reasonable being short, where you can decide
yep.
whether you're going to raise or limp or push all in.
Yep.
In these things, you just don't, when it gets to the later stages and you've been playing, you know, towards the tail end of this, you just don't have as much time. So the short stack in these is totally different than a short stack in a bigger event where you have a longer structure. Totally, totally different.
Yeah, and I'll tell you the other thing. You can play your position so strong in these, because if you are late to act and you look down at almost any two cards on this thing, the odds on those two people behind you wanting to risk their tournament life on what you do, you can shove with a 7-4 sometimes. You can shove with all sorts of things. The odds are that they're going to fold, and there's enough proportionally, enough percentage in that small and big blind, it's worth picking up. If I only have 900 left and there's 150 in the small blind and big blind, I want that 150.
Yeah, that fold equity counts for a lot.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
If you get in a good one, they may not realize that the blinds are moving up significantly in 4 minutes, and they're going to be really short and looking to push in with a marginal hand.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can catch the right people in the right spots and at the right time in these things where you can make some great plays and pick up some chips. And then they realize, oh my goodness, I'm desperate. Mm-hmm. I wish I called Dennis with my, you know, ace nine when he pushed in and Dennis really had a 4-7.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they laid it down because they thought they had more time.
Right.
So that's where their inexperience may, you know, cost them quite a bit.
One thing here, kind of jumping across, but I saw a tell by one of the dealers the other day when I was playing a sit and go.
A dealer tell.
It was just absolutely awesome on it. They had a little stop clock right there in front of it. And whenever he got less than a minute, he'd take it and set it up there in front so he'd make sure he'd remember it.
Uh-huh.
So I always knew when the round was about to end, within a minute of the timing or something like that. And I just watch him put it up there and I go, okay, well, they're going up next hand. Let's see where I'm at. You know?
Yeah. I like that. That's very, very good. And also, you have to remember when they do go up, these structures are not beneficial.
No.
I mean, essentially, in many cases, the blinds are doubling every round. You don't have a lot of the middle rounds. You don't have a 75-150 round or a 150-300 round. You could go from 500 to 1,000. Let's say you've got 12,000 in chips. Okay, 500 and 1,000 are the blinds. You've got 12 times the big blind. You've got a little bit of room.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next hand, it goes up to 1,000, 2,000.
Right.
All of a sudden,
absolutely.
You've got six times the big blind.
Right.
And now your strategy's got to completely change.
I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm going to jump off the subject again. Got another tell on a guy, and this was absolutely awesome. We're sitting down. We have not dealt hand one yet, all righty? The guy in the sixth seat, I was in the four, he was in the sixth seat.
How do you pick up a tell and you haven't dealt hand one yet?
This is what the guy said.
I can't
said.
Wait to hear this. I had to interrupt. I can't wait to hear this. Okay.
Unbelievable. He looks at the dealer and says, at what level do the antes start? Okay, this guy's never played a sit-and-go before.
There are no antes in sit-and-goes.
And I went, this is easy pickings.
That gets back to the beginning when you said, how can you tell, and you profile the players and all that. There's a lot of stuff that they do and they give away.
Yep,
who's
which you do have to do fairly quickly.
You really do, yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, these sit-and-goes, typically, you know, the rake for the house, it's very, very good for the players. So, you know, for listeners that haven't tried these sit-and-goes, I strongly recommend the sit-and-goes.
Yeah,
I think
they're
a great value. I think they're a lot of fun. I think it's great practice for when you get to a final table for other tournaments that maybe you haven't if you're not an experienced player.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the sit-and-goes. Great value, not much for the house. They're fun to do. You can do these last longer bets with players on the side with no juice for the house. Mm-hmm. You can do a heads-up last longer versus a buddy or versus a stranger. You're for sure going to find a player, two, three, four, or five, sometimes all the players that want to do last longers or who wants to do heads up and this and that for all different things with no juice, no rake. It's great, and they're a lot of fun.
I want to go back to stack strategy for a second because we talked about how you play the short stack. The converse of that is how you play the big stack. Let's say you are maybe not that maniac, but the guy who is playing well or catching cards, and early on you've got together the big stack. Are you now going to play bully because that's the way you're going to beat up on this table?
Again, it depends on the table. There's no, you know, standard answer to that on it. typically, I will take any pot that nobody else wants. If I'm in a hand and everybody else checks on the flop, I'm going to throw a bet out there on the turn if I've got absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
If I've got that 7-4 with three overcards on it or there or something like that. Because the odds are nobody wants to get in it with me because I have the deep stack. Therefore, they realize whenever you're in a hand with that person, whoever it happens to be with the deep stack, you're risking potentially your entire tournament there, your entire sit and go.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a certain mentality there that people can do it. Ooh, he just raised. Maybe even a small raise. You know, that can be almost as deadly looking as a monster raise type things on it. But I also try to be careful because I have that lead. Chips are so precious. I don't want to give it up. I don't want this guy in the five seat who's been playing wild to suddenly double up and now he's a threat to me. Let's keep him down while he's down there.
Mm-hmm.
Play your position again.
Yeah, I agree. You know, also, too, you've probably been playing with these people for 2 hours. If you're down to four-handed play and you've built up a big stack, you know, you had to have a big stack. You have to have people either, you know, severely short or typically a lot of them are already gone. So you have a lot of chips and there's not many people left. You're down to four-handed or so. Is this guy going to call me with queen nine? Because I've been active and I've been aggressive. Mm-hmm. You know, is he a calling station? You know, and I've picked that up from 2 hours of playing with this person. So maybe I need to protect my big stack a little bit, trap these guys a little bit more, or wait for a hand because I'm not short. So maybe sometimes you can sit back, and then other times it's time to be aggressive and they don't realize. So, of course, it is, and everyone knows it's a case-by-case and situational basis. You know, go ahead, Dennis.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things that you brought up earlier, know what your table image is. How did you acquire that deep stack? Was it by being aggressive? Are you playing 40% of the pots? You know, what is your table image?
Mm-hmm.
Or did you just happen to catch a couple of monster hands and double up on each one? You can be the deep stack at the table and only win two hands. I mean, you know, you don't have to be playing wild aggressive. You don't have to win a whole mess of them or anything. So know your image. And if you've done this with only winning a minimal number of hands, they're going to look at you when you come in at, oh, my gosh, has he got aces again? Type stuff.
Yep.
And you can use that to your advantage.
Yep. I'll tell you one thing that I've heard many, many times from people who are the deep stack, the big stack at the table, and a short stack moves all in. Somebody who's five times the big blind, six times the big blind, they move all in. The big stack says, oh, all right, I'll give you some action. And they call light, you know?
I hate that. I think that's a big mistake.
Jack nine of diamonds.
Yeah.
And they want to get in there. And then they miss, and now the other guy's doubled up, and so he's still alive. Remember, the idea here is to get the other nine players out so that you can win it. Keeping somebody alive, you don't want to be friends at that point. You want them to go. And if all they were doing was taking the blinds, stealing the blinds, let them do that. Don't call them light, because now you're giving up those chips that, as you say, are so valuable. You're going to need them later on.
And especially if you've got two winners. If it's one of these $65 tournaments where two people each get $300 and $5 go rake for it, you know. So there you go. You don't have to finish first. All you have to do is finish second.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're the deep stack when there's five people left, let's do the math. You only have to beat three of the other four people.
Yeah.
So, you know, coming in second doesn't bother me at all in these.
No. Same price.
And typically, you know, sometimes a guy will get desperate for sure when he's short, and he could move in with anything. But, you know, the less chips that you have, the more valuable they are to you.
Yeah.
So a lot of times the guy that's short, if he hasn't been active, he's moving in with something. And the guy that has a lot of chips, which is a big, big problem where guys don't protect the big stack, they are calling light, which I think can be a big mistake. It's nice to maybe call someone because you have an opportunity to knock someone out. If it makes sense, if you think it's a good call, if you think you have the best hand or you're getting the right price and it all adds up. But, yeah, whatever people do, don't just, you know, have a big stack and think, oh, I can afford it. I can make this call. Normally, I wouldn't call here. Well, if normally you wouldn't call here, throw it away.
Victor Anman told me one the other day that they were down to four-handed in a sit-and-go type thing. And he was third in chips on that. And he looked down to ace-queen. First guy who was this very small stack there, shoved all in. Victor looked at ace-queen, had the two guys behind him. He shoved all in. All right, no problem. The next guy shoved all in. The last guy shoved all in.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
All four all in pre-flop on four-handed when they were awarding two winners.
Yep.
How much you like the ace-queen?
Huh?
At this point.
At this point.
I'm not saying it's a bad play at all, but at this point, how much do you like the ace-queen?
Victor looked at him and said, which one's got the kings and which one has the aces?
Right.
Yeah.
He was just absolutely sure that he was totally killed, right?
And then he had the best hand?
Huh? Yes. He had okay. Well, no, he didn't. No, he didn't. There was a pair of sevens there.
Sevens. Okay, wow.
The fourth caller called with pocket sevens.
Oh, my goodness.
And caught a seven to take the whole thing out.
Oh, man.
Wow.
How in the world, when all you have to do is finish second, and you have three – the third guy who had like – I can't remember what Victor said he had, but it wasn't that great a hand.
I mean, he's calling to catch a seven.
Right. Yeah, I mean, no kidding.
He knows he's not in the lead.
He's no, I mean, someone's got to have an overpair, and then you're dodging all the overs if there's,
even
who
if
knows
they,
what that's out there. Wow.
But even if they don't have an overcard, if you're four-handed with sevens, I guarantee you're not a 50% chance to win that.
Yeah.
Because you're splitting with three other people on that. Yeah.
Now, let's talk about single-table satellites that you're playing, where it's not going to be two winners, but only one person's going to get the money.
Okay.
Most of these don't actually come down to one person getting the money because there's a deal made. Sometimes it comes down to just the last two. Sometimes it'll come down to three players. I mean, I've been in single-table satellites where I'm really late to go meet somebody for dinner. You know, I don't tell the people that at the table. But, you know, or I'm just sick of playing this, or I'm short-stacked, and, I'd like to make a deal so that I can maybe go play in a cash game or something else. Whatever else I want to go do, I want to get this over and done with and move on.
And when you get down to heads up, there is so much more luck involved, as you alluded to earlier. There's a lot of this where, you know, catching a card. I don't care if you've got queens and a guy with a king deuce calls you and that king comes, you know, game over type stuff. But for working the deal out, I got a bout of Joe on this. He does so much better than I do on figuring out the odds and going with it, negotiating with these guys. I watched this master work his charm so many times at a table.
I'm nervous. I'm a little out of practice. I haven't, I haven't played since the World Series. But the first rule would be, don't bring it up. Don't be the one to bring it up. Right there. You'd like the other guys to bring it up. In a way, maybe it's like a poker term, a sign of weakness. You don't want to bring it up. And then maybe you don't want to take the deal if you feel you're by far the better player. If you really feel you got great reads and great tells, and you've really picked up on this stuff, and you feel, you can take this down without it, don't take it. I know there's a lot of guys, I think Daniel, a PokerStars pro, great player. I think he has a no-chop policy. I remember that from the past. I don't know if he still does. I would probably bet that he still has that policy. He just doesn't chop. He feels he's the best player.
I would also bet that Daniel's playing very few single-table satellites.
Well,
it doesn't come up a lot.
Even with whatever it is that he would do, I'm sure it isn't the single-table satellites.
But
in general, he's just not going to chop with you. He's going to play, I would imagine. But, the other thing would be, what is the blind structure like? Is it really going to be what I said maybe a bit ago or when we had talked before about, a king 10 going to be versus an ace 9 and it's going to be who gets lucky because we're forced to go all in, then you're more apt to try to work a deal. If you think there's a lot of room left and you can play better than these guys and you have the chips, then you might gamble. But, there's a lot of different ways that you can do it. And
you do a lot of negotiating then?
You absolutely do a lot of negotiating. I mean, I would try to maybe do like a percentage that you could each, one guy might get one chip, another guy might get a chip plus some cash, and if you're the bigger stack, you might get a lot more and then just perhaps play for what's left over. You could do that. There's a bunch of ways you can do it.
I love the idea that Joe was saying, you try and let the other person bring it up first, because that also gives you some good details. Usually the guy that brings it up is the guy that is the most fearful of losing. Either he really needs at least a third of the money, or he thinks he is outplayed at the table, or he is the shorter stack. There's some reason he's bringing it up.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you can talk a guy, and look, it's part of the deal. It's just like life, business, anything. I mean, you can tell a guy, look, you want to leave, you get something to do, you want to go to dinner, whatever it is, how about you get your money back? You're the shortest stack. Get your money back. Go do your thing. You can live for another day and play another one later when you have more time. Sometimes the guy takes it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's one hand away, of course, from being right back in it and then could easily win it, if he's down to three-handed. So for me, to get a guy out and just give him back, 10% and give him his buy-in back, which is usually what it is, that's a great deal to get rid of that guy.
I've been in situations where it was a two-winner scenario, and the third guy was there and was just kind of sticking around. Nobody had mentioned anything about a deal yet, and he was just kind of sticking around. And then finally he said, if you guys give me my buy-in back, I'll leave the table right now and you guys can take it. Sold.
Right.
The other guy and I just immediately said, sold, done.
Yeah, and if he's a short stack and he feels uncomfortable at the table or whatever the heck, you give him the buyback, you see him get up, walk 10 feet over, sit on another one, and start another tournament.
Yep.
Because he's got his money. He hasn't lost anything.
Right.
In his mind, he's free rolling now.
Yep.
See, now, Paul, I have to do a little acting in that
spot.
Instead of in my mind, I'm saying sold. But at the table, I'm saying, you know, geez, I really don't think that's that great. But I guess I'll do it. Yeah. You know? Okay.
Oh, at that point, I'm just happy to get it over and done with usually. Yeah.
I don't know, you know, the guy feels bad. Like, that was too fast. You know, maybe I could have gotten more. You know what I mean? I don't want him to feel bad when he leaves. Like, you negotiated a whole lot.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're in a situation where you have 40% of the chips, the other guy has 40% of chips, and this guy's got 20% of the chips, you think to yourself, well, we've got him dominated. No, you don't. One hand, you double him up on one hand, yep. And then now it's exactly the opposite. Right. You're the guy with 20% of the chips. And now you're going, about that deal.
One of the things I love to do, if I've got the dominant, maybe I've got 70-30 or something like that, and I got a guy there and say, well, you know, I got too big of a chip lead. I can't really chop even with you. We'll either do a percentage, or I'll tell you what, if you can get back to where we're 60-40 or better, no problem, then I'll chop with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I double him up and all of a sudden I've got the 40%, we're chopping.
Yeah.
Right. But you know what? That's many times a fair deal.
It is.
And, you know, I definitely don't want to come across wrong when I'm at the table, but I've played a lot of those, and many times people are taking a shot, and they're not as experienced. It might be the guy that Dennis says when the antes come in. So clearly this guy hasn't played a lot. So if it gets to the end, I have no problem saying, look, I really believe I'm a much better player than you are at this, and I've probably played more than these than anybody this year. So I'll do a chop, but to be honest, I just can't do it unless it's a really good deal for me. You know, because I don't even want to chop. You know, I want to play. I think I'm a big favorite to beat you. But if you want to work something out that is fair, keeping that in mind, make me a suggestion and let's see if we can work it out. I don't want to, like, totally take advantage, but I'd rather play. And I like getting to heads-up play. To me, it's like, you know, do you want to chop at the Super Bowl and call it a tie? You know, I want to win. You know, that's what I got there for. I like playing heads-up and taking it down. That's part of the fun for me.
All right. You know? Here's the last thing we've got to mention about playing single-table satellites. At the end, you got to tip the dealer. I've seen so many guys who, even when they chop, they take their cash or their lammers and they say, thanks, and they're out of there.
Yeah.
These dealers are working for tips. If you were playing in a cash game, you would tip them. If you played in a major event and you won some money, you'd tip the dealers there. So what's fair? I mean, any idea what a percentage would work out to be?
Well, a lot goes with what size you're playing in, because if it's the 5-hour one, you know, $1,000 a piece might go for 3.5, 4, 5 hours sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing on a smaller one, it might be over in an hour and 15 minutes.
And if you're playing a smaller one, it's going to be the same dealer for the entire sit-and-go, usually. Not
usually,
always, but usually.
Usually a big one, too. At least at the World Series, the experience I had, it was always the same dealer.
Dealer doesn't get rotated out.
Mm-hmm.
He'll sit there for 3 or 4 hours unless he has an emergency that he has to leave.
So do you tip that guy more?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, basically, you know, you just figure how long he worked. And, you know, a lot of times if you do a deal, that might be part of the negotiation. Okay, you take care of the dealer, you know, give him $60 out of the cash, and you sign the ticket for the taxes. You don't tell him it's for the taxes, but, hey, I've already won a couple.
Here
and
comes
I have
Joe
a seat.
Again. I love it.
Do you mind if you sign off for this? And the guy says, yeah, I don't care. I get a lot of write-offs or whatever. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
So, okay, he gets the tax responsibility. He takes care of the dealer, you know, and whatever we split up the rest of the cash, and he's happy, and it's a good deal for him.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody wins. But, yeah, you got to definitely got to take care of the dealer. I mean, I wonder sometimes if I'm too cheap or if I'm too generous. It's a weird thing. You know, I maybe don't know the exact price to give, but you're right. There are a lot of people that just, you know, that you can tell the dealer's rooting for certain people, even probably in cash games. You know, one guy over tips, the other guy never tips hardly anything.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, just figure out how long they've been working and try to make it reasonable. Usually with all of these events, there's cash coming back with the seat or with the prize that you get. You know, so it just depends upon how big a one that you've played.
And there's a reason why if you win, like the example I gave earlier, and you win $300 for taking it, they don't give you three $100 chips. They give you two $100 chips, and they break the other one down so that you've got some 10 spots or quarters or whatever, and you've got money there. And it doesn't hurt anybody to tip that dealer a little bit.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, there's some basic information that you should know if you're going to be playing sit-and-goes come April when the World Series of Poker Circuit event comes to St. Louis, or if you're going to be traveling around to other spots or even in the World Series of Poker this summer. Joe the Poker Coach McGowan and Team PokerStars Pro Dennis Phillips, and I'm Paul Harris. This is The Final Table, brought to you by Harris St. Louis on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
This portion of the show is brought to you by PokerStars.net. Find the PokerStars in you. I'm telling you guys, if you want to learn how to play poker, this is the place to go. PokerStars is the world's largest poker site. It has over 30 million members and more free-to-play tables than any other site in the world. It is the place to learn how to play. And if you want to practice your poker skills, you go there. You download the software, and you start playing for free today. You go there for any of the major people. Look at this. Joe Cotta, Joe Hashem, Greg Raymer, Chris Moneymaker. You can play against me. Awesome, the things that are on there, and awesome the type of games. You've got 24/7, the best site in the world. Remember, PokerStars.net, that's also the home of the NAPT. So if you want to play any of those tournaments, if you want to go to the Mohegan Sun, you want to come back out here to Vegas, go to PokerStars.net. I'm telling you, this is the place to go. Find the PokerStars in you. Go to PokerStars.net.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, the only show in St. Louis with a poker millionaire. That's Dennis Phillips and his co-host Paul Harris on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Yeah, we are happy to be connected with Harrah's St. Louis and really looking forward to the World Series of Poker circuit event that's coming here for the first 2 weeks of April, which means it's just over 2 weeks away. April 1st, the satellites begin. April 2nd, the tournaments begin, and they won't stop until April 15th. Three tournaments a day, every day. At noon each day, you'll get the No Limit Hold'em events. At 4 o'clock, you'll be able to play the other games, including Pot Limit Omaha, Omaha 8, Stud 8, Horse. There'll be a ladies event, there'll be a senior event, and there are buy-ins of all kinds, from $200 to $300 to $400 to $500 to $1,000 to $1,500. To the main event on April 13th, a 5K event. And if you were listening to the last segment where we talked about sit-and-go strategy, those sit-and-goes will be going all day, every day, where you can win lammers that'll get you buy-ins to any of those events we've been talking about, including the main event. And if you win the main event, you're going on to the big main event this summer at the 2010 World Series of Poker at the Rio in Las Vegas. Dennis and I will be here for most of this circuit event at Harrah's St. Louis. Look for us around the poker room. If we're not in a tournament, we'll probably be in one of the cash games. Happy to talk to you. Looking forward to seeing you for two big weeks at the World Series of Poker circuit event here at Harrah's St. Louis. For details on the schedule, you can click Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, or go to Harrah's website, which is harrahsstlouis.com. Now, speaking of main events, here's the kid. And that is his nickname, by the way. He's now wearing it on the back of his Michigan hat that he wears in all the tournaments he plays. The kid, Joe Cotta, who just before his 22nd birthday won $8.5 million as the champion of the World Series of Poker main event 2010. But as he told us in this interview that we recorded at the NAPT at the Venetian a few weeks ago, he hasn't been playing a lot of poker since then.
Yeah, I took a little bit of time off. It's kind of a lot harder to grind online now, playing the same stakes and stuff like that. It's a little bit, you lose the drive a little bit, but trying to get that back, and took a break. So, and then I went back to play the live events in Bahamas and here out in Vegas and Bellagio. So it was good to have that time off.
Do you play different, or do people play different against you online now? Because I mean, you were known for fairly well before, but now obviously everybody knows you. So has it changed your play or your style of play any online?
I want to say no. When I have been playing online, there's some occasions where I notice I haven't been playing as well. And, I mean, I don't know if that affected my play or not, or if I just wasn't playing well at the time. But, I don't know, I've been getting back into it again. I started playing a lot lately, and I've been doing decent, so. And players that play against me, I guess it depends on the player. I mean, some players, I guess, may play against me. And, I mean, a lot of times it gets a lot of action from players I want action from, so it's a good thing.
Well, so much of this game is mental. I mean, you know it, I know it, we've been there. Keeping your mind in the right frame, staying concentrated, you know, not misplaying the hands, the whole bit like that, whether you're online or live. Do you find it easier to get distracted now because you've got so many other things going on in your life?
Not really. When I sit down at poker or when I'm playing poker, that's mostly the only thing I'm focusing on. I kind of tune out everything else. When I'm playing so many hands and playing so long where it's just like you just sit down and it's like riding a bike. You know, it comes natural, or driving your car. Do you really think about driving after a while, or does it just come natural? And it's one of those things you just, I think about poker when I play and don't really think about other things.
What advice do you have for other players who, like you, were online players who may not have entered the flesh and blood world of live poker, either in cash games or in tournaments? Now you've had experience in that for the last year or so. What would you say to some other guys who are strictly online players who may be thinking about coming to their first major event?
I mean, live is a lot slower paced. Online on Sundays, I'm playing like about 30 tournaments, and when I was out in Vegas, I don't even think I played that many tournaments. So
that's a good point.
So I mean, it's one of those things where you can't, like, I got really lucky winning the main event, you know, first time out there, but that's not how all tournaments go, and you know, they can be very grinding. But live poker, it's the same thing as online, except it's a little bit slower.
Yeah, much slower. In fact, a lot of online guys who I've played against, I can see them after about an hour. They are so impatient because they're used to playing so many more hands, not necessarily in one game, but because they're multi-tabling online or doing multiple events, tournaments at the same time. How do you fight that? How did you fight that when you first started doing it? How did you fight the boredom, if that's what you want to call it?
I guess it was good that I started off playing a lot of live poker when I was younger. I started playing a lot of live poker with my friends, and that's where I first started off playing. So I guess it wasn't really too hard for me to transition. Also, when I was younger, I also went over and played at Windsor. They had a big game over there, and when I was 18, I used to take up a few-hour trip to Indian Resort Casino. Mm-hmm. So I used to play at a casino when I was 18, too. So I had a lot of experience at casinos, even though I was still very young.
So you were used to it.
Yeah.
How many times have you watched yourself win the main event last year?
I don't really like seeing myself on TV too much. So.
Oh, no?
No, I try. But winning was a little bit different. I guess I saw it a few times. I don't know. It's still different to me.
Did you pick up anything different watching the TV coverage of it than you did sitting there, either at the final table or even earlier on? And did you go, oh, I completely missed that tell on that guy. Now I got it.
I don't really base too much stuff off tells. I mean, I try to, but I try to eliminate that and base it on other variables, but I notice a lot of weird facial expressions I make sometimes.
That you make sometimes?
Yes.
And have you said to yourself, I have to stop doing that?
Yes.
It's amazing. I know exactly what you're talking about. I've had some of the same things on that. You watch yourself on TV and you go, I didn't really do that, did I?
<You know? laughs> And have you been then playing in live tournaments and thought to yourself, don't make that face, don't make that face, don't make that face?
Something like that.
Well, you know what? One of the keys, Dennis told me this after he played in the main event a couple of years ago, one of the keys is knowing what your own tells are. I mean, you say you don't really do much off of other people's tells, but you got to know what you're giving off because you don't want to give away too much information. And that is a big difference between live and online, right?
Yeah, that's one thing I do pay. Even though I don't base a lot of my decisions off live tells, I do make aware to myself what I'm doing during hands. So if I'm doing something during a hand where I'm bluffing, I'll do the same thing if I have a hand. This way I can mix it up well if people are basing a lot of their live tells. Like, for example, just a small thing, like when I announce a raise, and sometimes I don't announce a raise. Like, when I announced the raise when I had a bluff, I made sure I announced the raise when I had a hand, too. So this way, you know, people base certain decisions off live tells. I make sure I mix it up really well.
That kind of brings it to an area I like. The game has changed so much in the last few years. It isn't just sitting at it and trying to watch the guy and the bluffing. It's so scientific now, the probability bets, the mathematics of it, the research. I mean, there are people that have complete playbooks on other players down there and what they've done in the past and how they played and how they play different hands and everything. Like the one with Isidore 1 that they had there, where they had the hand history of, a couple hundred thousand hands and how he played online.
Yeah.
Game has totally changed, and I think that's one of the major things. Have you noticed anything scientific, mathematically, something that way that way different in how you play now versus?
Yeah, I remember back in the day when I first started playing. I mean, a lot of people, when they 3-bet or re-raise pre-flop, so many times they just said, you know, aces, kings, you know, ace, king. And now it's like when you get re-raised pre-flop, it doesn't really necessarily mean that. And, I mean, the game opened up so much more, and the game's actually evolving a lot more. So people are getting smarter at it every day, and, you know, new talents coming in the game. So
we started off talking about how you took some time off, but then you got back into action in the Bahamas in January at the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure, the PCA. Tell us about that experience, because I hear it was a big red carpet deal for you. Is that true?
Well, I mean, I guess it's different being in the spotlight now because, I mean, everything's over-exaggerated and everything's, I guess they make a deal out of everything a lot more now. I mean, I'm never used to, like, looking at my actions before and paying close attention to everything I did. But now it's a little bit different. During the Bahamas, first off, the main event, I didn't like how I played. I deserved to go out of that event pretty early. I didn't play my best poker. Also, I played, I think, two other events during that, though. Actually, three other events. The 1K, 6 max, I didn't like how I played in that. The 5K heads up, I thought I played really well in that. I got stuck with a regular. I normally play heads up singles every day with 5Ks, and we had a good match, and I felt like I played that fine, but went out of that. And the high rollers, I liked how I played that event, cash in that.
You came in 11th in the high roller event.
Yeah, right? I was a little upset with the ending, how the ending went, but during the whole high rollers event, I thought I played really well.
When you say you were upset, is that you didn't like your play, or was just a bad beat story? Or
well, I mean, my play was kind of more high variance again, but if I knew that she was calling with a hand that she called with, I wouldn't have made the ship. But I ended up shipping, like, the button raise. I ended up 3-bet shipping ace-8, and she called with ace-9. And I went out of that. And then the red carpet you're talking about with the whole J. Nicole thing and everything online and stuff, where you get asked to pose for pictures with someone and everyone makes a big deal about it.
Yeah. Was it an entourage moment for you? Were you down there with your boys and you were living the whole life like the TV show Entourage?
No, not quite. I mean, I went down there with a few of my friends that play online all the time. And I think there was a red carpet event. And after the red carpet event, everyone from the red carpet goes up to the club and stuff. So I was hanging out with everyone that was at the red carpet at the club and happened to sit next to Jade. And then the photographer guy was going around and asking to take pictures and asked if we wanted to get a picture together. So we took a picture together. And the next thing I know, it's online. And everyone says, oh, is this kid dating Jade and blah, blah, blah. And everything starts escalating. Oh,
and you're thinking, I wish.
Yeah.
I mentioned Entourage. I think one of the guys from Entourage was down there playing in the PCA.
Yeah, Adrian was there, and he was with us in the club, too.
Yeah.
Cool. One quick question. Are you going to practice for your sumo wrestling for next year?
I don't know. I think I did pretty well. I think Isuke's the one that has to practice.
Wait a minute. There's a story here that I don't know. What's the sumo wrestling story?
Me and Isuke sumo wrestle each other on for ESPN.
It wasn't a contest.
Are you talking about you put on big sumo wrestling suits?
Yep. Oh, yeah. The sumo. Yeah. Yeah. Got us in the sumo wrestling. Got us in the headgear and everything.
And tell us the story.
Kicked these guys' butt. 3-0.
It was amazing. I've never done that before, and I mean, these things are hot as can be. They cut out of it, and they're just dripping in sweat.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You can't even stand up.
Did you do it?
I did not do it. No. No way in the world. But, I mean, you get knocked down, you have to have help getting back up, you know, and you're walking there, your hands straight out your side, you know. It's hilarious to watch.
It's like a big fat suit, isn't it?
Yeah. It's very hot, though.
Yeah. How long does the match last?
It lasts pretty quickly. But, I mean, with the whole, like, filming and everything, it took a while. So the matches last a little bit longer than...
The matches took 5 seconds. The filming took 20 minutes, you know.
Speaking of stuff at the PCA, I heard you got involved in some sort of prop bet with Hawad Khan.
Oh, the water slide thing?
Was that a prop bet or was that a TV stunt?
That was more for TV. We did all like a little water slide competition with a bunch of people, but at that time it was so cold out with the wind and stuff like that. It was just a windy day. It just happened to be a bad day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's really nice in Bahamas, but it just happened to be a bad day. And I was really sick at the time, too. And wasn't too exciting going out on the water slides, but last year when I was at the Bahamas, every day was gorgeous, and the water slides were so much fun.
So what was the thing with you and Hawad? You both were on parallel slides, leaving at the same time?
Yeah, but it was a pretty fun slide. There's two slides right next to each other, and it's like a race, and he kicked my butt.
Yeah, well, he weighs a little bit more than you, Joe, and gravity is the law.
Yeah, and the weight and the two-second head start had something to do with it, too.
Have you been invited to do any TV poker, high-stakes poker, poker after dark, any of that kind of stuff?
I got invited to High Stakes Season 6, and I really wanted to play on High Stakes. But at the time, it was 2 weeks, 3 weeks after the main event, and I was leaving after the main event after like a week. I was doing their interviews all day, so I was really worn out from the main event. I just got done winning it, and I knew really want to go stay an extra week and wait and play in one of the toughest lineups in high stakes poker. So I know I asked Maury to be on the show, and hopefully I can be on season 7, but season 6, the timing and everything didn't work out too well.
As we get closer to the WSOP this year, are you going to try and branch out and play some non-Hold'em events this year? Are you going to get involved in something else?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to. This year, I was debating if I wanted to play PLO or not when I was out here this year, but I figured I played a lot of PLO, but I never really had the tournament, a lot of tournament experience. I play tournaments here and there in PLL, so I don't really have quite the tournament experience in PLL. And I, you know, I wanted to be straight up with my backers and tell them that. Where I don't know if PLL would be the best idea for me at the time, but I've been working a lot on PLL, and I want to be playing a lot of PLL next year for the WSOP, and hopefully I can learn some other games and get better at other games where I can, you know, try to compete for bracelets.
Deuce to seven, triple draw, Raz. Yeah, I mean, there's some of everything there.
Yeah, some of the smaller player fields where it's a little easier to get bracelets.
Exactly. That's a very good point. If there's only 200 or 300 people in it, it's a whole lot easier to get a bracelet.
Is it a whole lot easier, or are you down to just the people who really know how to play the game and there's not as much dead money in there?
Well, even if you're playing with big fields with a lot of dead money, it's still a lot of landmines you have to dodge. I mean, the smaller the players, it's always going to be easier to win a bracelet. Not necessarily make money, like overall in general, but to win a bracelet will be a lot easier with smaller player fields.
Yeah. Well, good luck with the summer and all of your plans going forward. It's good to see you back playing live poker again.
Thank you.
And it's a pleasure to have you back on the show as well. We look forward to doing it again this summer when we're all at the Rio.
Yeah, pleasure to be on the show. I'm looking forward to coming back.
That's Joe Catta, the youngest ever winner of the main event of the World Series of Poker, joining us a few weeks ago at the NAPT at the Venetian. I'm Paul Harris, along with Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips. When we come back, it's the poker coach, Joe McGowan, one-on-one with Andy Block right after Andy got knocked out by Annie Duke at the NBC Heads Up Championship a couple of weekends ago. This portion of the show is brought to you by the Poker Players Alliance, the group that fights for poker players like you and Dennis and me and Joe and all of us. Whether you're an online player or a brick-and-mortar casino player or a home game player or like a bunch of guys I played with a couple of weeks ago, you like to get together with 30 or 40 guys at a country club on a Friday night, all throw a little bit of money into the pot and see who can be the last man standing to take it all down. If you're a poker player of any kind, the PPA fights for you. The PPA.org is the website. The PPA.org. That's where you should go to the Poker Players Alliance and become a member today. We'll be right back with the final table on 590 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcasts available on thechipleader.com.
They're flopping sets, hitting their flush draws, and taking your stack. It's Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris talking poker at the final table from Harris St. Louis Casino and Hotel on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Here's a conversation that Joe McGowan, the poker coach, had with Andy Block. Last week, we were talking a lot about the NBC Heads Up Championship, which Dennis played in and made to the semifinals before being beaten up by Annie Duke, who went on to win the whole thing. Andy Block was Annie's first victim. And right afterwards, Joe grabbed him, and they talked about one of the key hands that had happened in that match.
It was a great match. She played well. There was one big hand where I had ace-queen, and she had pocket jacks, and flop was ace-jack. Rag, and luckily I didn't go broke on that hand, but I did call a few bets from her, and that got me short. And then
can I ask you real quick,
yeah,
with that hand, what made you get away from it? Was it the read, the math, just the vibe? I mean, what happened?
She was on the button and she raised, I just called, and then I checked. And you know, in No Limit, when you only flop a pair, even if you have a good, think you have a good kicker, when you only flop top pair, it's not the kind of hand that you're looking to get all your money in if you're reasonable stack. Because most of the time, you get all your money in, you're going to be the only player that's going to call you, end up calling you, is the hand that beats you. So by the time the river, she makes a bet on the flop and bet on the turn, and she continues and bets the river, at that point, I can only beat a very few hands that she's going to value bet. Ace-10 maybe, ace-queen, which is the same hand I have. She's going to value bet ace-king. She's going to value bet a set. She's going to value bet two pair. She's probably, it's either she's bluffing, you know, or I lose pretty much. There are only a few hands that I can beat that she's going to value bet. So, you know, at that point, you just try to, like, call and hope to minimize the damage. Now, I could have raised at any point in time, and then it probably would have been all over unless I make it really tough laydown. And it would have been a tough laydown because, like I said, she might be doing that with ace-10 or ace-queen. And I want to play the hand in a way that I can get the most money from the hand like ace-10 or ace-9 or ace-8 or hand that's bluffed and without going broke against the bigger hand.
Now,
I think I succeeded in that one.
When you say you could have raised at any time and it would have been all over, because at that point, how deep you guys are, you would have been committed?
Well, it would have been tough. It would have been tough to raise without feeling committed. It would have been tough to get off the hand. I could have put a raise in at any point in time, and then she moves in, I can probably get off the hand, assuming that she got a hand better than mine. But, you know, if I'm beat, then I've caught lost that amount, and I'm not going to get a call from a hand that's bluffing.
Right.
And this way, I put the same amount of money in, and I see the showdown, and if she's bluffing, I'm going to get the full amount. If she's not bluffing, I'm losing the same amount.
This is really cool for me.
There is a small chance, though, that I do give her a chance to suck out on me. Maybe she's got a bad ace and river's two pair.
Right.
But that's, you know, a chance that you know, I was kind of, you just got to weigh the odds and think, is that a chance I'm willing to take?
What's interesting to me, you know, that's the first time I've even kind of heard you mention to me kind of a math type thing when you just said weigh the odds.
Right.
Like this whole interview so far, it's much more the other side. How much do you feel, I mean, clearly you're a math guy, how much does that maybe give you an edge over the average person that might just play betting patterns in that type of way where you do have such a strong math background with poker and other things as well?
In a format like this especially, when you end up getting short stacked pretty quickly, it's very important that you know like the percentage of hands to call and to raise, and it's it really helps you a lot. And you know, both pre-flop and after the flop, you're calculating your odds and your outs and the probabilities. And, you know, knowing when you have the right pot odds to call. And it really helps you an enormous amount in a game like this. Obviously, if you're great at picking up tells and reading your opponents, that's just as valuable. And it can be more valuable. But if you're that kind of player and you play against a player who avoids giving off any major tells, plays a very mathematical game, they might have the edge against you.
Right, I totally agree, because I'm a little more on the other side, at least I try to be, you know, I'm more into the tells. One elimination, that's it. It wasn't two out of three.
Right.
You know, you lose, you're out. With the depth of, you know, stack that you have and all, what percentage would you say luck actually plays a factor in this? I mean, there is a percentage of luck. You're not playing over a course of a year where the good player is going to win all the time.
Right.
What percentage in this would you think would be come up to luck?
It really depends on the skill difference of the players and the playing style. If you're playing very aggressively, I could train an idiot to make in this kind of format win a third of the time. I just tell them to push in every hand blind, or you can teach them another strategy: push in or fold, and they'll do even better. The thing is, when amateurs go and try to play the game, they're afraid, they let the pots be kept small when the other player is bluffing or when the other player has a weaker hand, and then they call when the pot's big, they can really be outplayed, and you could have like a 4-to-1 advantage against that type of player, a player that's going to let you play small pots and pick up pots off of them. But it's, you know, if you're against a player that's aggressive and loose enough, it'll be a tough match.
All right, right on. I really appreciate it, Andy. Best of luck with everything, buddy.
Thanks.
Good work. Thanks.
Yep.
That's the poker coach, Joe McGowan, one-on-one with Andy Block at the NBC Heads Up a couple of weekends ago. I'm Paul Harris, along with Team Poker Stars Pro Dennis Phillips, thanking you for listening. Hoping you'll join us here at Harris St. Louis for another edition of the Final Table next Tuesday at 2 or via the podcast available on thechipleader.com. This is 5 Night of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.